Coming up on Weekend America.
America is infested with zucchini.
God, these damn zucchini. I got some that are a foot and a half long. What the hell am I going to do with them, right? You know, hit somebody over the head with them.
But what if you could turn those zooks into cash instead of quiche? I'm John Moe. Also this hour, hippies taking LSD in the 60s wanted to reach a higher plane of consciousness, expand the frontiers of human possibility. Didn't always work.
One time when we took acid, I was seeing all these bright colors. I delved into a pile of clothes and put on all the bright colored things that I could find. I looked like an acid apparition walking through the room.
Catching up with the crew of the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And if you're going camping, make sure to pack your rationalizations.
Pretend we've really been through something, that we really deserve it. We were trapped on a deserted island, for goodness sake. We're entitled.
Sure you are. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From St. Paul, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Welcome to your weekend. Take a breath, relax, grab a cup of coffee. We're going to go all around the country this hour talking to your friends and neighbors. We'll visit backyards in Northern California and meet folks who are growing more produce than they can handle. We'll head over to Cleveland, where some urban areas don't get nearly as much produce as they'd like. Learn about a plan to address that. Later, we go camping in New England, as some city folk decide that when it comes to roughing it, they'd rather smooth it. What modern convenience would you take on a camping trip?
Okay, well, I consider the Coleman stove a modern convenience on the camping trip because we used to cook on the fire.
Rubbing sticks together, that's not really my style.
Microwave.
How about a camper to stay inside?
A bathroom that had a really nice shower and a jacuzzi tub.
Shower's nice. Yeah, that would be nice.
I just did camping. I was down in Huntsville 2 days ago. And I think the only modern convenience I wanted was a coffee pot.
I wouldn't take any modern convenience on a camping trip. I deliberately try to escape anything that even resembles modern life.
Okay, one true camper in the bunch. Those voices came from Nashville, Concord, New Hampshire, and New York City.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
Now we hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
40 years ago this weekend, people across the country cracked open a brand new book by Tom Wolfe. It was called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and it told the story of Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters.
When I first met Tom Wolfe, he was coming to interview Ken Kesey about the whole acid test phenomenon. And Tom was presented to us as the Pranksters as this very important journalist. So here comes Tom Wolfe with his little notebook and his pen, and he's wearing his usual pearl gray suit and white shoes, walking through the bus with all its colors and paint, and all we could think about was, God, we've got to get some paint on this guy.
In the mid-60s, Kesey and his crew hosted what they called acid tests in the San Francisco Bay Area, big parties where people got together, played music, dropped acid. And what happened at those parties spilled over into pop culture and ultimately defined the day-glow-painted, summer-loving acid rock psychedelic 60s. We spoke with two pranksters about how those trips shaped the nation.
So, I want to take some LSD. I want Babs to take some. Cassidy, you want to take some?
I would. Yes, I would.
I'm Carolyn Garcia. I was also known as Mountain Girl. Back in the days when we were doing the acid test, that was my nickname.
I am the Mountain Girl, and these are my merry band of...
We all had nicknames.
They called me Hardly Visible.
George Walker's nickname was Hardly Visible.
Our last tribute to George Walker.
It was something that was kind of a sarcastic name. One time when we took acid, I was seeing all these bright colors.
I delved into
a pile of clothes and put on all the bright colored things that I could find. Came walking into the room at Kesey's house in La Honda, and Hagen saw me with all this stuff on and says something like, "Holy smokes, it's hardly visible." I looked like an acid apparition walking through the room.
Reality.
I got my prankster name, Mountain Girl, one day at a party when I was just getting to know the rest of the prankster crew.
Somebody asked her, well, where do you live? And she says, up there on the mountain.
And they said, well, then you must be Mountain Girl. And then they laughed hysterically, and I've been stuck with it ever since.
A lot of us were living at Keezy's in La Honda, which is south of San Francisco and kind of in the coastal hills.
The pranksters usually had parties on Saturday, and that was when people could come out from Berkeley or come over the hill from Palo Alto.
And it was kind of like a psychedelic show and tell. People would get high and just kind of do little skits and stuff.
Bum, 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 bum. I'm coming to you from communications.
And sort of join in the fun, and we would set up the sound system and some movies out in the woods.
Well, you're making a movie.
Some of it was musical, some of it was just silliness.
The toilet! No, 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 certainly not in here.
They were well attended by a lot of Ken Kesey's friends, and they started to grow and get bigger.
Rock all around, rock all around, rock.
It just kind of happened as we went along. We realized that there was something about the way we were relating to ourselves and the rest of the world that was a little different.
What is happening down there?
Well, we're being assailed by a swarm of joints.
We were colorful, we were fun, we were athletic. To us, this was an American tradition. We believe in the pursuit of life and liberty and happiness. We felt like we'd discovered a certain kind of magic, and this was a magic that needed to be shared.
We had slogans.
A vote for Barry is a vote for fun.
Never trust a prankster.
A vote for Barry is a vote for fun.
And it wasn't like we were going to burn you or do you bad, but we would try to have an effect on people that would bend their mind in some way.
We are actually fourth-dimensional beings in a third-dimensional body inhabiting a second-dimensional world.
You know, we tried to get people out of their ordinary ideas and train of thought, and so you know, you can't trust us to react the way somebody else might react.
Switch. Gotta hit that one. There you go.
The Merry Pranksters, we had the bus.
Here indeed is a picture of the buses that first came into La Honda. And grinning off in the distance, Ken Kesey himself, the purchaser of the 1939 International Harvester.
You know, later there were lots and lots of buses, and there are still lots of buses, you know, hippies in buses all painted up and stuff. But we were the first one, and nobody had ever seen anything like that before. What it looked like was, as much as possible visually, was kind of like an acid trip, kind of chaotic mix of bright colors everywhere, and I think that was a lot of what motivated us to paint it like it did, like we did.
Right over the door of the bus, there was a little hand-painted sign that said, "Nothing lasts."
Nothing lasts, which came out of always losing stuff or breaking things.
And that was Ken's personal mantra.
Everything is transitory. There's nothing that is fixed in the world or in the universe. Everything is changing. Everything is constantly in a state of flux.
I certainly remember the first time I took any LSD. They gave me a little bit, and I was so intrigued by the way everything looked. And it seemed like all the redwood needles on the ground kept rearranging themselves into interesting and sort of informative patterns, like they were trying to tell me something. And I could feel the presence of the trees, but it was fascinating, and I wanted more.
Hello there, we've been waiting for you. It's me, friends, the old pointed head.
As the scene at Kesey's just kept getting bigger and bigger, he realized this is too easy to spot. We need to get this thing out of my house, or we're all going to end up seriously in trouble. And so he said, let's go rent places and do it somewhere else. And he came up with the term, the acid test.
Tonight's acid test will remain embarked on its perilous voyage the remainder of the night.
Everywhere you are, you're all acid testing and acid tasting.
He put up posters that said, can you pass the acid test? Before LSD became illegal, we would give people a dose of acid when they came in.
They were really meant to be a safe place to get high.
And it was kind of a test to see, you know, how well people could function in the situation. Right off, we connected with the Grateful Dead so that we had music, people would dance and stuff.
There was no barrier between the audience and the participants. Audience and the performance was one. And we would set up a strobe light. We'd have boxes of instruments that people could play. And there'd be live microphones sort of spotted around the room.
These three microphones don't seem to be working.
We also realized that this was revolutionary work because we were introducing people to a set and setting that really hadn't been done before. We wanted to sell this concept that your brain can do a lot of things that you didn't know it could do.
When we set out to do the acid test, you know, we were hoping that it would be big enough that we could, you know, maybe make a few bucks and, you know, support ourselves for a while with it. And who knows, maybe even achieve a modest amount of fame. But I don't think I ever had a notion of what a huge phenomenon it would become.
The immense popularity of the psychedelic movement did take us by surprise. We didn't really know that it was going to be such a gigantic ripple effect. And when the Beatles came out with Magical Mystery Tour, we cheered. All of that stuff is just, it's delightful because it was so different. This is what it was that LSD brought you to and brought artists and writers and musicians to, was enhanced creativity.
I think a lot of what solidified our position in it was Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
And the acid test will be us everywhere.
Everywhere.
That really put us into the mainstream of consciousness, if not the mainstream of culture.
I think that the acid tests were really a deliberate attempt to move consciousness expansion out into the public marketplace of ideas. We wanted to sell this concept that your brain can do a lot of things that you didn't know it could do. America needs the antic spirit that the merry pranksters embody. I think that the spirit of play and of fun is both, it's anti-war, it's anti-establishment. We need to keep our creativity. We need to keep our personal freedoms. They're precious.
We've lost all power.
Thank you for your cooperation.
Everybody is doing it, sir.
Thank you for listening. Without your clarity.
You know, if you stare right into your radio during that story, you can see colors. We heard from Carolyn Garcia, former wife of Grateful Dead's Jerry Garcia, and George Walker, two merry pranksters who still live near the Kesey compound in Eugene, Oregon. George Walker's working on his own book about the merry pranksters' bus trips. Our series This Weekend in 1968 is produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler. You can see videos of the pranksters' movies, along with links, on our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Cops are attaching GPS tracking devices to cars, hoping it leads them to crime scenes. Stopping crime, civil liberties, good news, bad news, no news. That's next on Weekend America. It's Week in America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Well, let's be honest. A lot of you have been watching the Olympics this past week. I know I've been wondering at what point the Michael Phelps bodysuit gets introduced into the public pool. You know, it's only a matter of time. Somebody's going to start wearing it. But a lot of things have been happening non-Olympic related, and they're kind of hard to figure out sometimes. And that's why we gather a panel together to sort them into good news, bad news, or no news. To join us, here's Bill Radke.
Thanks, John. Our guests this week are New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Red State writer Nancy French. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
And Sarah Haskins of the current TV show Infomania. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you.
Our first topic. As Russian tanks rumble down the streets of Georgia, the Bush administration has pledged its unwavering support to the former Soviet republic. The U.S. has airlifted Georgian troops from Iraq back to their home while providing the Georgian military with training and equipment. Does this loyalty seem like good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I think it's bad news. I think he should supply wavering support.
Go with the wavering?
I don't think we can provide anything but wavering support right now. I mean, I think it's bad news, but it reminds me of a line from my premier foreign policy document, which is the film Top Gun.
Sure.
Where the chief says to Maverick, son, your ego's writing checks your body can't cash.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's sort of what we're doing.
Bad news, they say. Nancy French?
I think it's pretty good news if they'd step it up a bit. I don't feel like they're really coming to Georgia's aid that much. Their agreement is to allow the Russians to stay there and to conduct, quote-unquote, protective operations outside of these territories, which is like asking The Simpsons' Nelson Muntz to protect the playground from bullies when he's the worst bully on the block.
What would you have the Bush administration do, Nancy?
Well, they just acted so slowly. I mean, even their rhetoric wasn't very strong. I mean, Obama had stronger rhetoric than President Bush. He finally warmed up to it. But I feel like Georgia's interest in integrity aren't being upheld.
I think our peacekeepers should go in and kill their peacekeepers.
Our next topic. The latest census report predicts that within 35 years, white people will no longer be the American majority. Here to comment is a diverse panel of Anglo-Americans. Do you know how hard it was to find three white people in this country on short notice?
We are going to be so cool in 2042.
Is this increasing diversity good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's good news.
Yeah?
Well, one thing I think is the diversity increases. When the time comes, it won't even seem like diversity any more than it seems like if you looked at the perspective of 1900 when, I guess, my parents came over from Russia. I mean, my grandparents came over from Russia and say, well, what's going to happen when all these children of Russian, Romanian, and all the children of Italians and all the Irish doesn't feel very diverse anymore? And I think it's great news, but no news in the fact that this is what has been going on sort of forever, and they're making sort of a fear-mongering.
I think it's great news.
Why is that?
Well, I think that America is a changing, evolving place, and I think stories about this are somehow pegged to this unspoken fear of immigration.
Mm.
And I think it's good news because when our society is more diverse, hopefully we'll stop freaking out about it.
I'm sure we'll have much worse problems come 2042.
Yeah? Oh, thank goodness.
This is going to seem, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, look at societies that, unless you're talking about that someplace, I don't know, like the Caucasus, which is multi-ethnically mixed but has a history of separatism. I mean, people come here and they become Americans and they still have their own cultures. So I don't think this is going to be the coming race war.
Nancy, do you agree that's still true? We're still the melting pot?
I hope that we are. You know, but a lot of times, like in cities, like I lived in Philly and New York, and everything is so segregated, like with Chinatown, and this is the part of town where the Italians live. And it's just, it seems still segregated. And I feel like maybe some assimilation would be good to encourage, you know, what is an American value.
Well, the other thing that's different, though, about these waves of immigration is they're not confined to the cities.
Being in rural Tennessee, where there's a lot of immigrants here for farm purposes, and I was trying to raise my kids bilingually, so I was trying to penetrate the Hispanic culture here so that we could hang out and have playgroups. And it's very difficult to do that. And so I feel like there is something, even in rural places, that is not making us really a melting pot, but more like a tossed salad where we're all individual entities and, you know, not really connecting.
But that is the first generation of people coming here. Mm-hmm. But their children will not have that barrier. Anyway, that's my – it'll be different, I think, especially by 2042.
2042 will be a utopia.
Our next topic. American police departments are increasingly using global positioning systems to track suspected crooks. You attach the GPS to the suspect's car and hope it leads you to a crime scene. Privacy advocates are objecting. Is GPS surveillance good news, bad news, or not news?
I had real mixed results with it because I put it on my dog, Ella,
uh-huh.
who runs away all the time, and it turned out that on those joints she was holding up 7-Elevens.
Uh-huh.
And so, we had to put it down. So,
yeah, you really are torn. So you're mixed. You're a mongrel.
As always.
Like his former dog.
Yes. Peace be upon him. Others?
I think it's bad news. I think we're entering a culture of surveillance. I'm originally from Chicago, and Mayor Daley's put up all these little cameras at different intersections to watch you come and go. And the thought that that's recording is creepy because I slouch and I don't want anyone to see that.
Your posture should be private.
If my mom ever saw these surveillance cameras, right? that would be the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's such a tiny little chip, so I think we minimize it. We're like, well, it's not a big deal. It's just like a stakeout. But what if someday it's not a tiny chip? It's a giant robot chasing your car around, you know? I think that would make people upset about it. That would make people genuinely upset.
Or even a small one.
Mm-hmm.
That can be annoying, you know.
But especially if it was shooting lasers, don't you think it would be more annoying?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with Sarah that it is kind of creepy to feel like you're under constant surveillance. But I feel like we kind of are already at that point. You know, at security cameras or at the banks, at hotels, offices, elevators, parking lots, intersections. It just seems like this is not the place to draw the line at the GPS. And also, I feel like, you know, like when kids got really upset when you have the cell phones that have the GPS in them so the parents can find out where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teenagers are the ones that are upset, not the ones that are obeying all the rules and not afraid of what they're doing, but the ones who are breaking the rules.
I personally, because I never do anything wrong.
Sure.
Right.
I would like a GPS tracking me all the time so it tracks all the good things I do.
Then you should get an award. And
I get points how I'm always obeying the law, uh-huh. and I'm always stopping on lights and everything else, and not having any affairs. And never having any affairs.
So really, us upright people are not getting any credit for it.
We're not getting credit. We could be getting good marks.
Sure. That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Weekend America's Bill Radke and our panel of off-the-cuff news authorities, New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff, Nancy French, she's the author of A Red State of Mind, and from Current TV's Infomania, Sarah Haskins.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
So I have all this extra produce from my garden here, some tomatoes, string beans, 11,000 zucchinis. Can't eat it all, but I can make money off it. Ahead on Weekend America.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. If you look at the Weekend America website, you'll see a section on the left-hand side full of small photos. What happens is it pulls pictures from the photo-sharing site Flickr that are tagged with the words weekend and or America, so we can see what America's weekend looks like. Lately, we've been seeing some pictures from the Olympics coming through. We tracked down two of the photographers and asked about them.
This weekend, my wife and I will be in Beijing for the 2008 Summer Olympics. My name is Scott Englehart, and I'm from Seattle, Washington. When we got our tickets in the mail a couple of weeks ago, both of us were just beside ourselves that we actually had the physical representation of the events that we're going to go see in our hands. And my first thought was, I've got to take a picture of these things. And so I went into our kitchen table and kind of fanned them out and just started taking all these different angles. And the one image that I really, really liked was kind of a close-up shot from a pretty oblique angle. And the light from above caught the holograms on the tickets in such a way that it kind of produced this gradated rainbow effect. And, you know, it's kind of corny, but it almost made them look a little more magical, you know? And I actually brought one of the tickets into work, you know, and let people touch it. You know, people were scared to touch it. It was really funny. But that photo is, you know, really, for now, it sums up, the building anticipation for us for our trip.
My name is Alice Mong, and I am from New York. I'm currently the Committee of 100's Executive Director. It's a membership organization made up of Chinese Americans. I'm currently attending the Olympic celebration here in Beijing, and I've attended the opening ceremony this past Sunday. The photo is of the Tai Chi masters. When the performers came out, everything was synchronized. And when they started performing the Tai Chi in slow choreography, it was just stunning, and it was just very magical, and it was almost surreal. As the evening got hotter and hotter, literally, I mean, and because the stadium is not covered, and so it was not, you know, really air-conditioned. I mean, there definitely was airflow, but where we were, it was so hot. But it just didn't damper the spirit. I mean, people were buying food and drinks and sharing with each other with just a sense of great camaraderie around us.
Your Flickr photos can be on our website, too. Just tag them with Weekend America. We'll find them. Around our Weekend America studios, Olympic fever is high. One of our producers has confessed to already weeping openly several times. But other people have different feelings about the Olympics, feelings like dread, resentment, hate. In the spirit of equal time, we wanted to hear from folks who just want this whole Michael Phelps beach volleyball, uneven bars, equestrian trampoline thing to be over with. Buzz Bissinger, New York Times columnist, leads off our parade of bile.
It was really about 10 to 15 years ago when I just soured on it. You know, the 96 games in Atlanta had the bombing. Then you had the Salt Lake games, the Winter Games, where there had been rampant bribery of IOC officials. And it just seemed with every Olympics, there was another scandal.
I realized I wasn't really a fan anymore when the athletes were appearing younger and younger and younger. It seems as if oftentimes children are being picked at an early age and just kind of being pushed towards meeting the dreams of maybe a parent.
You know, I think that Putin used the cover of the games to invade Georgia. I mean, I think this is what it's become.
I know I was very disappointed when they started having all kinds of this is a visa moment rather than this is a, let's say, Michael Phelps moment.
They don't come close to the ideal that was set by Pierre de Coubertin in 1906 when the games were resurrected. I just think they're rotten with corruption. I think the way in which cities go after them and spend literally billions and billions and billions of dollars that could be spent in so many other more important places, I just think it's obscene.
That was Buzz Bissinger, columnist from the New York Times, and Ann Flint from Jackson, Tennessee.
Whoa!
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm John Moe. The economy may be sagging, but there's one thing that is booming this weekend. That tomato vine in your backyard, and the raspberries in your neighbor's backyard, or all those squash in everyone's yard that look like someone hooked them up to air pumps. It's the end of summer, and fruit and vegetable gardens are bountiful. It's like a vegetarian wonderland out there this time of year. But what to do with all the stuff you've grown once you've grown it? Weekend America's Chrissy Clark talked to some folks who found creative ways to harness the bounty of their backyards.
I used to live in a very small town where people took their vegetable gardens very seriously. The joke was that the only time you really had to worry about crime was at the end of each summer, when there'd be a rash of break-ins to cars and houses. Someone would sneak in and leave a pile of homegrown zucchini.
And then there's, of course, a competition about, oh, zucchini and chocolate chip cookies, oh boy, you know, or zucchini and this and zucchini and that. God, these damn zucchini, I got some that are a foot and a half long. What the hell am I going to do with them, right? You know, hit somebody over the head with them.
Bludgeoned by zucchini. A sad way to go. So what do you do with all your beautiful homegrown produce? David Eichhorn, a 71-year-old retired teacher who lives near Berkeley, California, has a modest proposal.
Think about this right here. You grow good produce of any kind, I don't care if it's fruit or vegetables, people will buy it.
David is not a professional farmer. His backyard is small, but it's packed with plum trees, raspberry bushes, boysenberry vines.
Well, that's a good berry. That's a really good berry.
He and his wife gorge themselves and then sell the rest to local grocery stores, restaurants. He's made $1,100 so far this summer. Alice Waters' Shishi Bistro Chez Panisse is his best customer. David guesses over the course of his life he's eaten there at least 70 times for free in exchange for his berries. He says it's easy. Just pick your best homegrown stuff, better if it's something a little exotic. Do some research at a grocery store to see how much it's going for, and then
knock on the door.
Star Grocery in Berkeley is one place you can sell your weekend warrior produce. Family-owned stores like this are usually more open to buying backyard fruits and veggies than a big chain. Adrian McAvilly is the manager.
It's fun to write a little sign to tell people, you know, this food came from a couple hundred yards away, you know. People want to fill their table with things that are local and that have a story behind them.
And with the recent scares around contaminated peppers and tomatoes and spinach and lettuce, there's some comfort in being able to track your food back to someone's doorstep. Plus, there's the benefit that stores can stock up on rare fruits that don't ship well or are just too finicky to grow on a large scale. Hachia persimmons, pomegranates. Adrian says every year a neighborhood kid sells him pounds of the coveted Meyer lemons from his backyard. And how do you negotiate the price for something like that?
You just look at market value, and then, you know, when it's a 15-year-old kid, you'd probably give them a little sweeter deal than you would to to a farm.
Note to self. But even if you're not a 15-year-old kid, there's still hope for your backyard enterprises. In fact, even if you're not currently growing anything in your backyard and have a thumb as black as coal, there's still hope.
Did you put some fertilizer on these at all?
You know, I've been having trouble with the fertilizer.
These guys?
They need fertilizer.
They need some help.
Donna Smith, co-founder of Your Backyard Farmer in Portland, Oregon, will come to your house once a month and, for about $100 a visit, teach you how to grow your own food. Robert Norton is one of Donna's clients.
She's my guru.
Robert is standing in a backyard that once had a patchy lawn he didn't really like to mow. He had visions of a lush organic garden he could harvest for his family dinners, but no clue how to start.
Some people can read a book or go on the internet and get the information and know exactly what to do, but I'm the kind of person who needs somebody to actually guide me.
Aside from a few sad corn plants, it's working.
Tomatoes over my head, my cabbages have been bigger than my head, my cauliflower was bigger than my head. I've harvested beets, carrots, cucumbers.
And if you don't have the time or the inclination to garden at all, but still want to eat stuff out of your own yard, Donna will do it for you. For $1,500 a season, she'll provide you with a weekly supply of fruits and veggies that she grows on your land. Of course, whether you're farming your yard all by yourself or with a personal trainer or paying someone else to do it for you, there's always the risk of growing more than you can handle. Robert tells me he hasn't resorted to selling his giant lettuce heads yet. He still likes to give them away. but only after a demonstration of how good they taste.
Here, I'll prove it. I always do that. I always bring it to my neighbors and do that, you know, and say, yeah, it's good. You want it? And they say, yes. I haven't been turned down yet.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
You can find pictures of this bountiful backyard harvest. I'm looking at them right now. They're on our website, weekendamerica.org. You got some zucchini here, some eggplant, some peppers, some artichokes, some yellow things. I'm not sure what they do. This time of year, I was on my way to the studio, and somebody had left these tomatoes in the break room. And I'm looking at it right now. It's huge and red and green and crazy. It's like the size of a baby's head. And I don't know how they grow them, but then they just leave them in the break room. They're all over the place. Check out the information, weekendamerica.org. Well, that abundance of homegrown produce is great, but of course not everybody has a garden. Not everyone is close to a garden. Not everyone can get those natural foods. Food desert is a term for places, usually in dense urban areas where grocery stores are scarce or they're hard to access for folks who don't drive. The corner store is often the only source of groceries in these food deserts, but those stores are often more likely to stock junk food than the makings of a healthy meal. A group in Cleveland is trying to change that through weekend events at corner stores around the city. Reporter Julie Grant brings us the story.
One of the things I like about shopping at big supermarkets is all the free samples. The stores try to get us to buy something new.
How you doing?
Hi, come on over.
Boy, you know you want to try something.
These volunteers are in a rough part of Cleveland's west side. A lot of houses have been boarded up or demolished. They're at a convenience store. It's actually called the Convenient Food Mart. People here seem surprised to be offered a square frittata.
Like the veggie or the ham?
Veggie.
It's really juicy. A lot of tomatoes and peppers and onions and potatoes.
Oh, that looks good.
All the products and the recipes we're featuring can be purchased in the corner store.
Okay.
So we do have the recipes here for you.
You know what? I'm gonna go get my roommate. He's a little overweight. Okay. And he's trying to eat healthier.
Good.
And I'm gonna go get him. I'm coming back now.
The convenience mart is on a busy road, across the street from a tavern and a liquor store. Vieta Perry and her four kids live around the corner. It's hard for her to drag the whole family 15 blocks to the discount grocery store.
They take my food stamp card here, and this is where I go.
Vieta tries to get her six-year-old daughter to eat a bite of veggie frittata.
Ba-ba-ba-ba. Here, Mandy.
Like.
Vieta says her kids will eat healthy food, but there are so many temptations for them at the corner store. It's a lot like you'd expect. Cups for a soda machine, a cooler full of beer, cartons of cigarettes behind the counter. But it's well lit, and there's a surprising variety of groceries on the shelves. You can get regular or whole wheat pasta, lots of canned tomatoes, and some kind of wilted-looking produce in the fridge. Erica Abrams works with Cleveland's Corner Store Project. They're trying to get places like this to sell healthier foods.
He's got hummus. How awesome is that? When do you see hummus in, you know, a corner convenience store?
The owner of 18 years is Faris Alame. He's from Lebanon, but he raised his kids in this neighborhood and in this store.
We're living here 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, I mean. It's like another house. And my customer, other family, I mean, you see him every day.
Alame wants to offer even more healthy food, but he's not sure what else to stock. He'd like to sell fresh fruits and veggies, even locally grown produce. But he can't afford to have food rotting on the shelves. That's one reason the Corner Store Project has stepped in, to show people they can make delicious, simple dishes like frittata with food from Alame's store. But customer Vieta Perry has a more urgent need.
I just told him he needs to give me some Cinnamon Toast Crunch. They got all of this Wick cereal in there, and my kids won't eat that stuff.
Folks from the Corner Store Project know it's hard to get people to make healthy choices, so they offer Perry free classes.
Do you need my address in here?
Just phone number, we'll give you a ring. And
yeah, call me.
Okay.
The Saturday demo has gone on for 2 hours. Store owner Faris Alame and Matt Russell of the Corner Store Project are now thinking bigger than just free frittata.
Small farmer's market right here?
Yeah, be a good idea.
With the local food being grown?
I don't care. If it works out, make it 5 days a week.
Yeah, well, we'll work together.
as a team.
Yeah, as a team.
In Cleveland, I'm Julie Grant for Weekend America.
Today, volunteers are serving a 7-layer bean dip topped with fresh green peppers, tomatoes, and lettuce at Sam's Corner Store in the St. Clair area of Cleveland. Now, we know that you may well be listening in your car this weekend, running errands, but when you get home, get on the computer, will you? Go to our website, fill out our listener survey, weekendamerica.org. Plenty of rowing and sailing events on tap at the Olympics in Beijing today. Good thing the forecast calls for sunny skies and 83 degrees. For a look at some domestic weather and events, here's Molly Bloom.
Chuck Chansey Park in Fresno, California is a minor league baseball stadium, but tonight it's a battlefield. Parker, the big yellow grizzly mascot, takes on the Philly Fanatic, a weird green alien mascot from Philadelphia, in a series of challenges including ATV racing, obstacle course, and passing out from heatstroke in thick fur costumes under bright sun and 101 degrees. Forsooth, good sir, avail me of your picnic basket. Get used to talk like that if you're in Cave City, Kentucky at Yogi Bear's Renaissance Weekend. Partly cloudy and 84 for kings and queens, knights, and, breaking from historical accuracy, cartoon bears. I think I envisioned this event as a kid after a long day of Dungeons & Dragons, cartoons, and sugary cereal. What do you do when you have a ski resort and no snow? Hurt yourself. At least we assume that will happen at some point at the Oregon State Downhill Bike Championships outside Eugene. Ride a gondola up, bike back down under sunny skies and 91 degrees. It's a chance to see the Cascade Mountains and to ride Oregon's finest medevac helicopters. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Molly Bloom for Weekend America.
When young New Yorkers go camping, you'd think they wouldn't be able to handle life without modern conveniences. And yeah, that's pretty much what happens. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. So, we know gas is crazy expensive this summer. Honestly, had you ever in your life used the word staycation before this year? So, we've been footing the bill for your vicarious holiday on our show. We've been letting you tag along on other people's summer travels. Producer David Maxson went to New England recently. It was supposed to be the perfect getaway from not just the hustle of the city, but also, crucially, the bustle as well. And it was a perfect getaway. Except a story about a perfect getaway would be really boring, and you wouldn't want to hear it, and we wouldn't put it on the air if it was completely perfect, right? Well, sometimes when things go wrong, it actually works out really well. Here's David.
My Brooklyn neighborhood is lively.
Yeah, I'll give this a brother and son of a...
It started to grate on my nerves. I need to get away, relax. Let's see. Burton Island State Park. St. Albans Bay, Vermont. Accessible only by boat. Nature Center, trails, park store with food service. My girlfriend Con and I drive up and take the ferry over. We stand on the bow of the boat invoking Leo DiCaprio and grin stupidly at what a perfect idea this is. The island is beautiful, and we get the tent up and go for a swim. It's super calm and nice, just the way we imagined. On the way back to the campsite, we check out the island store.
That's after the weekend? Or the week?
It's your basic resort-style Monopoly, overpriced, understocked. They sell hamburgers, but refuse to sell us hamburger meat. We agree to try and avoid it. We'll catch and eat fish instead. And luckily, the fishing is great. We catch a couple right away and cook them over the campfire. This is a life, we say, because that's what you say when you go camping. As we're falling asleep, though, there's a rustling around the tent. I keep turning on the flashlight to see what it is, assuring Khan there's no dangerous animals out there. But she tells me it's not the animals that scare her, it's the humans. Then she sees something. She's really freaked out. My adrenaline shoots up as I fumble around for the flashlight. I finally get it turned on, and there, right in front of our tent, is my backpack. In the morning, we make some coffee and decide to explore the hiking trails. We have fish sandwiches for lunch. Then we swim some more and fish some more. Back at the campsite, we talk about what to do for dinner. See, summer lake fish, especially the bass we've been eating, is pretty fishy-tasting fish. And everything, our hands, our clothes, seem to reek of it now. So we give in and head over to the store to order a sandwich. But at 6 o'clock in the evening, it's already closed for the night. And the day's last ferry has already come and gone. At this point, an unexpected panic sets in. Khan feels the only way to sleep through the rummaging mice and menacing humans and backpacks is some combination of wine and Benadryl. Things not found on this island after dark. She seeks the counsel of the park staff who are closing up shop for the evening. She asks if we can get off the island with them when they leave. But they live on the island. She begs them. There must be a way. There's talk of a taxi service and even of swimming off the island. Finally, she gets them to give us a canoe.
She's like, she knows I'm desperate. I've been like going back and forth for like 2-3 hours.
Yeah. Does she think we're crazy? Well, so what do you want to get?
Hot dogs, brats. I like brats.
Yeah.
And hamburgers, because we do have 2 hamburgers.
The lake is beautiful and calm, and the sun's setting as we canoe out. Once on shore, we spot an Italian restaurant. We gorge ourselves on pizza and lasagna and drink cold beer out of glasses. We pretend we've really been through something, that we really deserve it. We were trapped on a deserted island, for goodness sake. We're entitled. But when we get back to the ferry landing where the canoe is stashed, the gates are locked. The park is closed. We can't get back until morning. We feign disappointment for long enough to try and fool each other, if not ourselves, and pretend to consider sleeping in the car. Later, at the ski lodge-themed Cadillac Motel, sitting in the air conditioning, watching a gigantic television and eating leftover pizza, we drift into the kind of sleep that only comes from getting away with something, from being let off the hook. The next morning, we paddle back to Burton Island to retrieve our stuff. The water is choppy this time and nearly tips over the canoe. The island almost seems to be rejecting us for cheating on it. On the ferry back off the island, we're still reeking of fish. The relief I had the night before is replaced by a pang of guilt. The vacation was over, and we had pretty much bailed on the whole secluded island thing, hadn't we? I mean, we couldn't even take 3 days of no restaurants or convenience stores. That's pretty weak. But then it hit me. This was actually a perfect vacation. Back in Brooklyn, the noise goes on, but I find myself being a little more tolerant of it. And I realize the vacation was kind of a microcosm for summer in general. I love summer, and I always look forward to it. But eventually the whole enterprise becomes soiled with bug spray, sunblock, sand, sweat, and watermelon rinds. I start to look forward to the crisp air and colors of fall. That's a good thing. It means summer has been a success, because I'm over it.
No sleep!
In Brooklyn, I'm David Maxon for Weekend America.
Well, just like Ad Rock and Mike D and MCA, we use microphones to talk to you, but we need you to talk to us through our website. Go to weekendamerica.org and take our listener survey. Tell us what you think of the program and what you'd like to hear more of. We're listening electronically. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Desiree Cooper, who is selling her son's furniture on Craigslist this weekend, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba, who will be running, biking, and swimming, and also stretching, and also icing. Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Christina Pena, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, Bill Radke, who is going swimming in the ocean and having dinner with his wife, though thankfully not at the same time, and also Mark Sanchez, who's going to try to trick some neighborhood kids. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program on our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. I'm going to be heading out to the ballpark this weekend to watch my beloved Seattle Mariners take on the local team, the Minnesota Twins. I'm going to wear my Mariners baseball cap. I'm going to be that guy at the ballpark. Talk to you next week.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire. And now I think I'm ready to bust a move.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.